Welcome to the CMO Marketing Podcast, where we interview business owners, leaders, or marketing professionals to find out their lessons and stories for success.
Welcome to the 100th episode of the CMO Marketing Podcast, formerly known as the Paper Planes Marketing Podcast, formerly known as the Simon Dell Podcast. It's changed a bit over the time. But one consistent thing that's been with me for the whole podcast is Simon Bell. Well, they haven't kind of been consistent with me all the time.
No, but since the Simon Bell show.
You've done a lot of episodes. How many episodes? Maybe about 4 or 5?
I think so.
More than anybody else.
Well, there you go.
That's the important thing.
That is. Well.
So welcome to the very first, this is our Joe Rogan style. It's good, isn't it?
It's great.
Fake pot plants.
I love it.
Things like that.
Nothing says podcast like a plastic plant.
She really should have been ferns, between two ferns.
I think that's taken.
Yeah, that's kind of done. It's been 100 podcasts. And I guess what I wanted to do for this one was reflect back on the previous 99 podcasts and talk about some of the things that I've learned from it. Because we're doing this for 3 years now. I've had 99 different guests. And I've also in that time, perhaps in the last 2 years, started doing mentoring sessions, obviously, which you've done a lot of in your time. And I think I've done about 120 mentoring sessions, probably give or take, because I'm not exactly counting. And I think what I wanted to do was talk about the things that I've learned out of all of those sessions. Because if nothing else, and if nobody ever watches these episodes, right, no one ever listens to the podcast or whatever, I guess from my perspective, it's been a massive learning experience.
Yeah.
And you have your own podcast. Is that one of the things that you kind of get out of yours as well?
Yeah, well, that's the reason I started the podcast.
Yeah.
Was purely selfish reasons.
Yeah.
Because if I want to have a chat with somebody around the world,
yeah,
that's the person I'll go and interview.
Yeah.
And explore and, you know, delve deep into their world. So, yeah, that's... And I kind of have this theory or this belief that if I find it valuable and I find some juice in what they're sharing, then someone else will.
Yeah, yeah. And I kind of, it's been a massive opportunity to open doors. I mean, I've had Glenn Richards from Shark Tank, Mike Goldman from Big Brother, some other bigger sort of names, but sort of senior executives in companies that if you knocked on their door and said, oh, I'd like to talk to you, they'd tell you to... go away. But somehow, as soon as you say, I'd like you to be on the podcast, all of a sudden they're like, oh.
That's right.
There's a little bit of ego in play there, isn't there?
A little opportunity for them to kind of expand. And so I find the same thing, you know, reach out randomly. If you reached out to somebody on LinkedIn to connect or to sell them something, they'd be like, oh, yeah. If you reached out, like when I reach out to them to say, hey, would you like to be on the show, check out your profile, 9 times out of 10, they're like, yeah, up for it.
Who would be on your top of your wish list for podcast guests for your show?
Whoa.
I'll put you on the spot there because that wasn't
that's on the list. Top 10. Marianne Williamson would be cool.
Yeah.
So she wrote a book. She got a body of work that talks like kind of focuses on the Course in Miracles.
Yeah.
So she wrote a book called Return to Love.
Right.
Which I know sounds a bit airy fairy for your type, but. It's a beautiful book. She'd be up there. Who else would be up there? My goodness. Yeah, put me on the spot. Eckhart Tolle would be up there. So, you know, obviously with the podcast being more around the Zen.
Oh, okay.
Power of Now.
Right.
A New Earth. Both good books to check out.
Right.
Yeah, they'd be up there for sure.
I haven't even thought about, from a business perspective, obviously, he's not going to be able to be on the podcast, but somebody like Steve Jobs and understanding, his thought pattern, his route to creativity, all of those kind of things. I know this is going to sound really weird, and this is going to probably end up in a shouting match with somebody. I'd like to interview Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Well, I think it would just be the most eye-opening experience. I am certainly and by no means a Trump fan. I would never vote for him, but I just want to understand.
It would be an experience. And I think
it's the best way to describe it. Yeah.
Cheers, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're not being sponsored by this, but we thought we might have a beer for
the 100th episode.
Yeah.
We've got can I mention the brand or what? The Goat?
Greatest of all time. I think that's obviously what Goat. I don't know whether that's what this is supposed to.
Kind of fitting, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Kind of ironic.
He would be great to interview. Yeah. Because he'd be entertaining. And I think what would be most amazing about it would be you get to see behind the veil. Like, you just kind of go, oh, actually, everything we see is exactly how he is.
I mean, if nothing else, he's authentic.
He speaks his truth.
Right, so I've got these 12 things that I've been sketching down for the past sort of 2 or 3 months as I knew I was kind of building up to this. And just for everyone's benefit out there, I'm going to go through these. The Simon's here to kind of make comments on them and add some thoughts and, you know, maybe take them a little step further. They are in no means any kind of sensible order. And some of them may cross over a little bit with others. But as I said, these are things that I've taken from people that I've interviewed and mentoring sessions that I've done with the Queensland government in the last 2 years. And by no means this is an exhaustive list. There's more of these, but these were the things that sort of really stick in my head. The first one, I think, is probably the one that really stands out that I hear repeatedly over and over and over again from a lot of successful people and a lot of entrepreneurs, is the ability to sell. And you, having come from a second-hand car sales background much earlier on in your career.
A reformed used car salesman. Yeah.
How important is it that people are able to sell in business?
I think, and you've heard me say this before, I think either selling door-to-door or selling used cars should be like conscription. That everybody should do 12 months when they leave school. Oh,
12 months.
12 months of grassroots selling. First reason is the ability to sell applies to all areas of life.
Yeah.
You know? And in fact, if you look at, I believe anyway, truly great leadership. Leadership is the ability, and people are going to disagree with me on this. I don't mean selling from a used car perspective, like manipulation, but I mean, you know, if you can lead somebody through a process, if you can understand the psychology of a human being and inspire them and influence them and, you know, guide them in a particular direction, that is selling.
Yeah.
And so I think the art of selling is essential for small business owners because it has applications across not just, you know, winning more business and converting more, you know, converting more work, but just understanding human beings.
And I think for me, the underlying thing about the capacity to sell or the ability to sell is the level of confidence that you have in whatever it is that you're talking about.
Mm.
The higher your level of confidence, the more natural that selling and being able to sell comes to you.
Yeah.
Because you trust what it is that you're saying.
Yeah.
And the thing that perhaps sticks out of mind, the story that sticks out of mind the most for me with this one is that I've met tech startups who are trying to attract a certain type of customer base. So let's call them small cafes or whatever they are. To me, I go, if you're the CEO of a tech startup and you've got your CTO building some software and whoever else is involved in your organization, the first 6 months, 12 months of your life should be spent out on the road, knocking on doors, trying to talk to people.
Yeah.
And if it's cafes, the only way that you're going to do that is to walk into the cafe and say, can I speak to the owner?
Yeah.
That's hard.
Yeah, it is. It can be challenging, yeah. I mean, it depends on what your disposition is.
Yes.
Some people take to it more than others. But being on the cold face just gives you that harsh reality of whether your product or service is any good. But it creates that resilience as well.
Yeah.
And I think getting that feedback from the cold face just allows you then to, you know, go back to your product or your service offering and explore it. And
I think it also helps as well. Once you understand the numbers, if you know that you talk to 20 people and then you get 19 rejections and that you get one person interested, then you can sit there and scale it up from there, go, right, well, for me to get 5 customers a day, I need to speak to 100 people. You know, so as soon as you understand those numbers, you go, right, well, selling can just be a process. We just go in and have that conversation. And I know that out of the 20 people I hit, I'm going to find someone that's interested just because the law of numbers, the law of averages would suggest that I will find someone if I follow this particular process.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, I think, you know, selling is down to confidence, selling is down to getting the right process in place. And probably the last thing on this one is the ability to actually close the sale at the end.
Mm.
So many people are good at talking about their brand and talking about their business and talking about what they do. They also need right at the end to sit there and go, right, do you want to buy now?
Yeah.
Or have some underlying statement that actually causes an action.
An action to be taken.
The customer.
And I think it ties in to marketing. If, you know, like if you understand how to build relationships, how to build credibility, like how to really tap into your key selling messages.
Yep.
Like why should somebody buy from you? I think that's all of those components. And then like you said, the ability to ask for the sale or the confidence to ask for the sale.
Yep.
And you're right. I think most people, like they trip over at the finish line.
Yeah.
And they do great jobs at selling features and benefits and building rapport and credibility and relationship. And then they just don't follow up and ask for the sale or they just don't ask or they don't follow up. Or
yeah. And that manifests itself in a lot of other ways as well, because you see online systems where they do a great job presenting their product. Then when it comes to the sale point at the end, it's this kind of horribly, you know, obtuse form or process that they have to get through to purchase it and put a credit card or invoice or whatever it is. Mm. It's just not an enjoyable experience. So not being able to close a sale online, even when there's no people involved.
Yeah.
Is just as important. So that was my first one. It's important to be able to sell. My second one that I've seen a lot of is that growth in most businesses, be it business or it being personal, comes from a series of small sideways or progressive steps. And there's always exceptions to this rule. There is always exceptions to this rule. But I see most people that have grown to where they've got to have just taken lots of little forward steps, a sideways step, forward step, sideways step. And they're going up some stairs.
Mm.
It's never just this and this. And often, sometimes it's often better to do sideways than it is to sometimes go forward.
Yeah.
You know, and you see those people with the CVs that I've looked at LinkedIn that I've interviewed where you go, yeah, I see why you moved into that position. It kind of makes sense. And I think it was Annie Parker who I interviewed said, you know, your career doesn't make sense. Well, you can't predict it looking forward, but it makes sense sometimes, like when you're looking back, you kind of understood why you went through those processes. Is that, and again, I see the same from you. It was a series of kind of steps.
Totally. One led into another.
Yeah.
You know, I talk about, you know, waking up one day 5 years in as a used car dealer wasn't on the agenda leaving school, that's for sure. Super grateful for it. But I think from it, whether it's from a business perspective or as an entrepreneur within a business or in the business realm, you know, every time you take a step forward, you learn, you get that feedback, you kind of adapt. Is this what I want? Is this not what I want? Is this what the vision for the product or the company is?
Yeah.
And then to be able to, I'm not a massive fan of the word, but to pivot or to take those sideways steps and sort of go, okay, well, actually, you know what? That's a little bit better and refine. And I think it's that constant series of refinement, which is distinct from idea of the minute.
Right, yes.
Which I think is an important point to make as well. Like, we're not saying, you know, every day you come home with a new idea that takes it off in a completely different direction.
We will talk about that in a minute. I think that, so number two was to say to people, don't keep looking for the big leap. Don't keep looking for the big step. By all means, have your eye on the prize, the end goal and all those kind of things, but be looking for those opportune sideways steps, forward steps, you know, where you can just kind of make a little incremental improvement to maybe your job, you know, where you're maybe earning a bit more money or where you're moving into a same company but learning a different skill where you can kind of, you know, and I had this conversation on Twitter yesterday. Of course I did, because
as you do.
And I deleted the Twitter app for two weeks and then went, no, I'm going back. I can't stand all those people out there who are wrong and I'm not correcting them.
What would the world be like?
Yeah. They all need to hear my opinion. But she was complaining that her daughter had, you know, what was she complaining about? Her daughter had taken up graphic design and done 2 years graphic design or 2 years graphic design studying and hadn't managed to find a job, and then had gone and done something else and still hadn't managed to find a job, and then had gone and done beauty school and now was on a temporary worker. She was a part-time, what do you call it, part-time casual,
right,
at 27 years old. And I'm like, why would you do 2 years of graphic design, not find a job, and then give up? And that makes no sense to me. To me, it was like, if that's really what you want to do, it's a series of small steps. It's,
yeah,
you know, learn graphic design, go and intern somewhere for a day a week, or, you know, go and do some stuff for free for someone or a charity. Because fucking thousands of charities that need pro bono graphic design work done out there. Go and do that. Build your portfolio up. Put something online. And again, I had to, that was, you know, another one where I, going off on a tangent here, but I'd had another, this was back in COVID. This was back in March.
Back in the early days, when
I spoke to someone and her husband had been laid off and he was a designer. And I said to her, look, I know people who want designers. Where's his online portfolio? She's like, oh, he's getting it together now.
Mm.
And I was like, right, send it to me when it's done. And then I think I checked in with her 2 months later in the middle of May and said, where's the, send it to, you didn't send it to me, where is it? She goes, oh, he still hasn't done it.
Well, I mean, that ties in with, as you were speaking, what I was thinking of there is, as you mentioned, that example, you know, doing graphic design, then beauty school. And if she really wanted to do it, she could go and do other things. And that's, I think, the key question is, what do you actually want to do?
Yeah.
Like telling the truth about that. And I think, you know, quite often, especially when we're young in either career or, you know, in the entrepreneurial journey, there can be that default, well, this is what I think I should be doing.
Yeah.
Or this is what I think my parents want me to be doing, or they overtly told me I should be doing.
Yeah.
But I think that's important with this, is the constant incremental improvements, those small incremental improvements, moving towards the thing that you actually want if you tell the truth.
Yeah.
And if that means going in a completely different direction, tell the truth about that. If that means you don't want to be in this business anymore, then tell the truth about that.
For people to say, I'm going to do 2 years studies of graphic design and then go and land a 80 grand graphic design job, that's not how life works. It's that incremental series of small 100%. Steps to get you up to that.
100%.
So number three was one I echo over and over again, and I've just thought of one that he, my business partner, Matt downstairs, I might add that to my number 13.
Mm.
I'll get that. Anyway, a self-created job is not a business, and I won't dwell too much on this, but so many people that are in business don't actually have a business, they just have a job. They've just managed to create themselves a job, and they might have a few staff, and they might have a company car, and they might have an office, but the business makes no profit.
Yeah.
Barely manages to pay them a salary, that is a job. And it's a crappy job as well.
Mm.
Because some of them I've seen have got the skill set that if they went out and got a job in the commercial world, they could earn $150,000 a year, not have the stress of having staff and, you know, and lead a relatively easy, relaxed life.
Yeah.
Instead, they've created this entity that doesn't really run properly and isn't really making them a lot of money. And I saw it yesterday, and she, you know, lovely lady, very smart. And I'm like, this thing's not paying you enough money.
Mm.
This isn't a job. This isn't a business.
This is a job.
It's a job.
One of the first books I read in my business journey, it was quite profound at the time, was Robert Kiyosaki's Cash Flow Quadrant. And, you know, I know there's been a lot of politics around Robert Kiyosaki, and, you know, he seems, you know, big in the early 2000s and it kind of died out. Yeah. But it was profound because I come from a working class family, single income, truck driving family. And so the idea of being a business owner, the word entrepreneur meant that you're a tosser. Like that was words.
That's when it wasn't
cool.
Was it trendy? Yeah,
that's right. And so I remember reading Cash Flow Quadrant, and it spelled that out beautifully. Like, you've got that self-employed, that business owner, and it made the distinction between the two.
Yeah.
And that was profound for me. That was a turning point in business. And from there, it was like, okay, cool. How do I create the systems so that I can have other people do the work and produce a residual or some sort of passive or leveraged income?
Yeah.
And I remember sharing this with a group only probably last year. We're talking about the context of business or the reason for being in business. Like, what was your purpose?
Mm.
And kind of even bigger than that, it's like, what's your relationship to business? And I shared with a group, and I said, my context for business for probably the last 6 years, even before just before Staffberry,
yeah,
was, and this may not be for everybody, but how much money can I make with the least amount of hours invested?
Yes. Yeah.
Right? Now, I said that's because it's been my context for six and a bit years. It's just the norm. Like, that's just what you do. Like, you're looking for things, and okay, how do we systemize that? How do we streamline it? Da, da, da. For this group, it was profound.
Mm.
It was a real paradigm shift for them. They're like, I didn't even think about that as a possible kind of context for the business. It was like, how do we, definitely about how much revenue we can generate, how much profit we can generate, but the piece around the time element and the leveraged income producing opportunities there, wasn't on their radar.
Yeah, an old manager of mine when I worked back at Lion Nathan said his job, if you wanted to be a manager, his job was to teach people to be lazy. And I was like, what? This was like, you know, because most managers, you know, we want you really busy, we want you to do this. And he was like, no, he said, we want you to be getting the best results with the least amount of work. And I'm like, yeah, shit.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
I still say that to groups that I lead, of employees, of clients that I've got. Mm. You know, like when we talk about, well, I led a session on Friday for a business of lawyers. And, you know, we're talking about high performance next year. And quite often people collapse the term high performance. When the boss comes in and we're going to do a seminar on high performance, people tend to default with, you want to make me work harder and longer hours. And that was one of the opening lines. Yeah. It's like, hey, this doesn't, like high performance doesn't directly correlate with more hours.
Yeah.
Because we've got efficiency and effectiveness in there as well.
Absolutely.
So I think that's great. I'll drink to number three.
Go, drink to that one. Number four, this will cross over with another one later on, but the people that you surround yourself define your success. And there's two parts to this. So the people that you surround yourself with will define your success, and you might not always be the right person to run the business.
Mm-hmm.
So a friend of ours had built a software startup, and he realized early on in the picture that it was his business. He owned 100%, but he was not the CEO. He couldn't be the CEO. He didn't have the right capacity. Whatever it was, he didn't feel that he fitted in as a CEO. Still an owner, still on the board, still making decisions, but somebody else was leading that company.
Right.
And he surrounded himself with the right people to help him succeed. So rather than he sit there and do it all on his own, he sat there and went, I'm going to get the right people around me.
Yeah.
And that was quite interesting, the fact that someone could delegate what was his baby to someone else to run.
100%. I've had clients that have done the same thing.
Yeah. You
know, really good craftsmen, technicians, professionals that really enjoy their craft or their profession and don't enjoy the concept of business. And so the best thing that they've done in that case was to find somebody to run the business and having those clear expectations, you know, to be able to, because the mistake would be to take a step out of that CEO role and then still try and influence the direction. You've got to be able to trust.
And there was still, from what I understood, there was still heads butting against each other, everything. And that's going to happen.
Well, potentially.
Yeah.
Unless there's a level of self-awareness enough to kind of say, well, you know what? Okay, this is what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And that's a self-aware leader right there.
Yes.
To say, right, okay, well, you're in charge of the leadership aspect, the running of the business.
Yeah.
I'm going to be the best professional, technician, tradesman, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Because that's what I actually really enjoy doing.
Yeah.
But I agree. You know, surrounding yourself, Jim Collins, you know, ask who, then what.
Okay.
And you know, making sure you're asking, like, who can I, this is the vision for the company.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, how are we going to fulfill on that? Who can we get to support us in fulfilling on that vision? And they're going to come with their own ideas. And
I think it was Tom Potter I heard. Tom Potter used to own Eagle Boys Pizza.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, have I got the right? You I know do. The right Tom.
You have the right Tom.
I heard him talk once for an hour, and he was just, he was just really clear. He said, I knew nothing. He said, and he said, to a degree, I still don't. He said, but I had to find people, operations people, human resources people, lawyers, financial people.
Yeah.
So I surrounded myself with a team who knew all these things much better than I could. It's the old Steve Jobs adage, is just hire people. Why hire good people and tell them what to do?
Mm.
Hire good people and let them tell you what to do.
Yeah, you know, Henry Ford even before that.
Yeah,
you know, that was his analogy
yeah.
of the process. So, yeah, man.
So people's a big one. The number five was the guy. God, I'm going to forget the business now. This is where I said to you that I've done 99 shows with bugger all research and preparation. And why change a habit of a lifetime?
I remember the episode, and I can't remember his name either.
They were a staging company down in Sydney.
That's the one.
No, can't remember.
Mm. Apologies.
And they, yes, we'll put it in the show notes. And they, in the middle of COVID, got everything cancelled. I think he said in a week they lost every single job that they had. And then a week later, they'd started making flat-packed office furniture.
That's right.
Because one of their third business partner or whatever had come in and said, why don't we make work-from-home furniture?
Yeah.
This is going to go on for a while. People are going to be working from home. They need a desk. They need this. They're blah. So these guys had gone out and bought some, not plasterboard, because that's not what you use, whatever the MDF.
Yeah.
Bought some MDF and started making these slot-together desks.
Mm.
And I never forget what he said. He said they made a single post on Facebook that went viral. And I know I do viral in that because everyone's idea of what's going viral is just, it's all very wanky. But he said, I think he posted it on Tuesday afternoon or a Thursday afternoon or a Thursday morning, something like that. He tells me about it in the podcast. But he said all of a sudden it just went boom. It just got traction, right? It got lots of people commenting, sharing, news coverage, but everything. About how this poor event company had staved off the, you know,
yeah.
going under and having to fire everyone by creating flat pack furniture. And I'll never forget what he said. He said it was entirely timing. It was entirely the time that they posted that post on Facebook.
Mm.
And he said if he'd done it a day earlier, or a day later, or even an hour earlier, or an hour later, right? He was sure that it would never, ever, ever have had the same success, and they would have never reached the level. I think they did a million flat pack desks of something crazy, whatever. Yeah. It was crazy. But that's I go. It's amazing how all the planning and all the preparation in the world can sometimes, or all the lack of planning and preparation in the world can sometimes be completely irrelevant and just boil down to you doing something at the right space at the right time.
Yeah. I mean, it depends how meta you want to get here, but of course, but yeah,
yeah.
Serendipitous, synchronicity. Yeah. But yeah, you know, right place at the right time. And I think, you know, the thing to be mindful of, just mindful, is to A, not use timing as an excuse.
Yes.
But also B, not use timing as not just, timing definitely plays a role.
Yeah.
But also, too, to be able to acknowledge the fact that they had the idea, they followed through with the idea, they created the idea, they took action on the idea.
And the guy who designed the desks had years of designing shit like this. There was all this experience in his head, you know, 20 years worth of experience for him to be able to overnight cough up a design.
So I think that's the real takeaway from that story.
Yeah.
Again, not invalidating the time.
No, you're completely right.
It's that ability to go, to look at a situation, especially in stressful times when most of it's just fight and flight, and to, with cool heads, go, cool, what can we do in this particular moment? And it may not be, you may not have been in cool heads either, so, but it might have just been like, hey, let's run with that. And but Starbury for us, you know, getting into outsourcing in that period of time when we did, there's no way I'd start an outsourcing company today.
No, and a friend of mine who makes and imports coconut water.
Right, that's
you know,
that
three
sales.
four years ago when he started doing it, he was like, I'm looking for a trend that hasn't happened yet.
100%.
Found coconut water. Next thing you know, he's putting containers of the stuff into Woolworths.
Yeah,
you know, I'm going, if he'd done that a year later, nothing. Yeah, it wouldn't have happened. They always talk about a great story about J.K. Rowling about getting stuck on that train for 6 hours or something. And while she was stuck on it, she had the entire Harry Potter story of every single book. She wrote it all down while she was stuck on this train.
Mm.
And you go, if she had never been stuck on that train, would any of this happened?
Right.
But you're also right in saying that there was a huge amount of preparation for her. And everyone talks about, you know, she had this genius idea and this light bulb went on while she was stuck on a train. She'd been reading children's fantasy right. books for fucking 15 years. She'd read every single one there was,
yeah.
you yeah. know. And even after this, she still managed to luck out by finding a agent that loved the book and wanted to, you know, a lot of other agents told her to piss off.
I think this ties in, what it's speaking to at a bigger level is this addiction that people have to want to find the one thing.
Oh, fuck
What's
yeah.
the one thing that makes me successful? What's the one thing I can do more? It comes back to your point number two.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just the one thing. It's the, yeah. it's the sequence of activities because there's so much to that. It's, yes, being stuck on the train. It's having the mindfulness to not then get the shits. And,
yeah.
You know, because there could have been other people stuck on the train complaining, pissing and moaning and
yeah.
completely wasted the 6 hours yeah, or whatever yeah. it might have been. So, but yeah. Again, not to invalidate the point of timing, because timing does make yeah. a difference.
Timing is an important, can be a single important factor
yeah.
in amongst a lot of other important factors.
100%.
So, number six, everything happens in a funnel. And this was kind of one of those ones
What's
that I was
one?
Like, well.
What does this mean?
Well, basically, to me, everything, every sale, everything you do with a prospect, customer, client, whether it's B2B, B2C, everything happens in this classic sales funnel. So they first of all got to discover who you are. You've then got to get them to engage with who right. you are. You've then got to build a level of trust, and then you've then got to make them buy.
Right.
So every time I look at anything, any B2C, B2B product, whether it's a chocolate bar to a car or to a mining product, big, small, $1 to $1 million of value, whatever it is, everybody goes through those same four steps in order to make a purchase. And, you know, any business that sits there and says, oh, we're different, okay, you're not. The funnel might happen quicker.
Yeah.
Your cycle you might be may shorter. Miss a step. People might skip a step, but it all happens in exactly the same way. And that is one of those things I want to say to people is yeah. like, if you want to know why something isn't selling and why your business isn't selling, it's because you're not doing one of those steps properly or two of those steps properly. It's the discover, engaged, trust, buy. That's, and we spoke about it earlier about people making it hard for people to buy things.
Yeah.
You know, people make it hard for you to trust them as a business. People making it hard for you to engage with them. If you don't answer your phone, you don't reply to your emails or, you know, but also then the top of the phone is making it hard for people to find out that you're there.
100%. I mean, this ties in with what I was sharing. I mean, that's one of the things I'm grateful for with selling cars.
Yeah.
I got taught a road to a sale.
Right.
You know, which I can laugh about now in retrospect, but it was critical because it taught me that process of leading somebody through a process. Now, not pushing them, not conjoiling them, and then that's the art form of it. Right. There's the science of it, and there's the art form of actually, you know, leading somebody through, but that's the marketing conversation as well. It's because people like to be led.
Yeah, absolutely. You
just got to lead them through it.
Yeah, and this brings me to an email that I had the other week, and I was going to do a whole podcast on this one, but I'll tackle it now. I did an introduction to a prospect client of ours to my kid's daycare, right? So the kids had been stopped from going outside because the concrete was too hot. New roaring daycare.
Right.
Concrete was too hot. Kids might burn their feet. Blah, blah, blah. So let's put aside for the fact that that's an utterly ridiculous rule. And in all honesty, all kids need to burn their feet at some point to understand that the fucking concrete is hot.
You're going to do it at the beach. You might as well do it at daycare.
You know, the only way you're ever going to understand sometimes that the pan on the thing is hot is by putting your fucking hand on it. That's the, you know.
Totally.
And, you know, you can say all these other training methods and teaching methods. Some people just need.
Well, it's experiential, isn't it?
You know.
Totally.
Yeah, but anyway. Anyway, I digress.
Rant over.
I said to this prospect client of mine, you need to talk to them. He does a concrete covering, like a coating that you put on top of the concrete.
Yeah, right.
And then it stops the concrete getting hot. Well, you're not touching the concrete anymore. You're touching the coating, so it stops getting hot. Kids can walk on it. It lasts for 100 years, whatever it is, right?
Nice.
And I said to him, I did an introduction and email. He then followed up with an email back to the daycare and said, look, here's our website, here's our Facebook page. Go and have a look, see what you think.
Hmm.
And that was it. And I emailed him back and said, what are you doing? Like, there's a lead here. All right, go and talk to them. go and do a quote. And he's like, well, generally goes, we find that if they do the research and they want our product and they like our product, they'll come back to us just naturally because they're interested in finding out what we do. And I went, No.
You're not there yet.
I was like, that's not, you know, you're not an Apple.
That's right.
Right?
That's
right. You build a store. Because
it's possible to build a brand that where you've got to qualify for it.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's very pull marketing campaign.
Right? But you're a small business that's looking for new traction.
Yeah.
And I said, you need to go and do a quote for them. And he said, oh, you know, tire kickers. The whole tire kicker excuse comes in. Because they're not a cheap brand. They're quite an expensive brand. So he goes, I go out, do a quote. They find it's too expensive. And I'm like, this is a speculative quote because there's a company that runs this daycare that runs another 100 daycares.
Right.
Right? This is an ongoing problem across all the daycares in Australia because kids have burnt their feet recently, blah, 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 blah. Some people still want to buy. I have three people for that. People fall into three categories. People that don't want to buy your product.
Right.
Right? People that want to buy your product, right? And there's this massive group in the middle that probably would like be quite interested in your product if they find out a bit more about it. Totally. They find out more, they trust you, they engage with you. He's sitting there going, I just want those ones over there.
Mm.
And I'm going, there's this fucking whole fucking group in the middle here.
And you can. Like, if that's what you want, this small percentage of people who already get it, then but you're going to spend a truckload more on marketing and branding and positioning, and it's going to take time and decades.
It's just so much fucking slower.
Way slower. So, and that comes, I love it, dude, because it comes back to going to that sales process of the qualification.
Mm.
If the tire kickers, people's, I think one of the things that in the, about asking questions is probably one of my key lessons over the years is there someone's ability to ask powerful questions, open-ended questions, qualification questions. So if they are a tire kicker, then you don't go on quote.
Yeah.
But you find that out early up.
I got a great, a little sales video off TikTok a while back, and it was the guy just asked the customer three questions, open-ended questions, and then they repeat the question, they answer the questions, the customer answers the questions, and then he on the fourth question, whatever, he sums up what they've just said to him in the pre, and you've probably been through this through the car sales. Yep. They sum up what they've just said to them in the previous answers to the three questions. And then all of a sudden, all these people, apparently the customer goes, wow, this guy really understands my business. I go, fuck, he's just repeating what you said, you know, but it works.
Totally. If you say it's the truth, if you say it's a lie, if I said it's the truth.
Yeah.
You know, and so one of the things we got trained in was, based on the conversation that we've had, you know, what I'm hearing is, it's just that active listening.
You do that. I hear you do that. Based on what you say, what I'm hearing is, wow, that sounds, I've heard you say that a lot. I feel like I've been sold.
It's called active listening. Active listening.
Do you know, I just need to check where we're at with this because I'm like, all right, okay, no, we're all right. We're good on time.
Probably time for another beer.
I've got to drive. Oh.
Right.
One beer I get, I feel like I'm okay with. It's two beers, I'm like,
pushing the envelope. Be responsible.
Number seven, action trumps ideas. I don't think anyone's going to disagree with this. I'm guilty of it. You're guilty of it. Lots of people we know are guilty of it. Ideas. It means absolutely nothing. Action is what's important.
A lot of broke geniuses.
Which actually then links in with my number nine.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll do number seven and number nine at the same time because they were kind of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the number nine was one of my favourite quotes.
You love this.
I love this quote.
I remember when you got this quote for the first time. I remember you told me.
I wish I remember where I met you on the same day.
It was like, I just got this amazing quote.
I wish I knew where I got it from. It was a podcast. Mm. It was someone on a podcast. And it was... The best way to succeed is to have one good idea and then never, ever have another one.
Yeah.
And that speaks so many volumes. And I'm still trying to learn that. 46 years old, I'm still trying to learn that quote, right? Because what it says to me is that it's all about focus. Have 100%. One good idea, maximize that.
100%.
And put all those other ideas in a little basket, box, black something book, over black there, book. Black book.
Yeah.
And... You can go back to them mm-hmm. at another time when you've absolutely maximized. And we know people where they've they're constantly bringing in new ideas to their business or adding new things onto their business, and it's detracting from their core focus,
100%.
Their core revenue models. So to me, action trumps ideas. It's if you're going to have an idea, take action.
Yeah.
And then once you do have one idea, stay with that idea. Stay the course on that idea until you know it's absolutely exhausted.
100%. Two of my favorite Chinese proverbs. The fish always rots from the head.
Yep.
And the man or woman who chases two rabbits catches neither.
Neither. Yep.
Yeah. Because I learned that the hard way. Having three companies running at the same time and not having this efficient systems running.
Yeah.
You know, one was making great cash, the other one was going okay, the other one was going like terribly. I was going to say something else then.
Yeah.
Hey, going terribly.
We're all swearing here.
And and then it only took, you know, one little, well, it was more than one little. We got broken into six times in 6 months.
Right, so yes.
That helped. Yeah, that didn't help the situation. It was a clothing shop, but it was, you know, like then all just the house of cards just toppled over because, you know, there wasn't enough time and energy to be able to spread my focus between those.
It's like a jumper and someone's just pulling at the thread.
That's
and
right.
All of a sudden, boom, the whole thing
just falls apart.
Yeah.
So, I agree. Focus on the one idea.
I know that's so hard because a lot of businesses that might be struggling or growing and not getting the revenue that they think they should be getting suddenly see something over there and go, oh, quick revenue, quick profit, quick opportunity here.
Yeah.
But all you need to do is put 10% of your time over there, and that's 10% of your time that's not in here.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, the focus on this one just decreases.
Yeah.
And 10% of the time there, another 10% over there, another 10% there, and all of a sudden, this one's not getting the love that it should be getting.
Totally. This became really clear. I met there early on in my journey. I think I was probably 5 years into business. I met this guy who, it's going to sound terrible, was just boring as batshit. Like he was, and here I am thinking this is what an entrepreneur looks like. It's salesy and da 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 da, like larger than life, and that's what good selling and leadership is. And this guy was so methodical, so analytical, but was just uber successful.
Yeah.
And he just did one thing. I won't go on because I know that it'll give it away because it's a household name. And I met him and, void of all other opportunities. Just every day, just did the same thing consistently. Now, at the time, that would have driven me mad. Because I did suffer from entrepreneurial ADHD,
mm-hmm.
which was just like, like the cat with the laser beam, which is probably why the notion of Zen and mindfulness appeals to me and that transformation, that journey, because it was something that I learned early on is I've just stay focused. Stay focused. And for me, I can only speak for myself, but I would assume that it's applicable to others. FOMO.
Yeah.
You know, the fear of missing out. You know, not telling the truth about an idea, and again, it could be from a fear perspective, like, oh, actually, I don't want to get outside of my comfort zone to be able to see that through. And so when push comes to shove, you're like, oh, well, actually, let's pivot and go over this direction rather than actually addressing and dealing with, you know, what that confrontation is. I'm sure there's others there, but that's the ones that stick to that pop in.
Number eight, which was sandwiched between those two, one was you only have yourself to blame.
100%.
That took me some time. But when I've done a lot of mentoring sessions, and I always hear this thing, I just can't find the right staff.
Yeah.
Right. And there was a printing company that I went to years and years ago, with our mutual friend. And, we sat down with the guy and he said, I've got a BDM on. He said, he's not, you know, cutting the mustard. And I was like, right, well, what's going on? He said, I can't sell our products. We're not getting any new customers, or it's not growing quick enough, and blah, 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 blah. And I said to the owner of this business, who'd been the owner of this business for a good 20, 30 years, I reckon. I said, so give me the elevator pitch of you guys as a business.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck, he struggled.
Mm-hmm.
5 minutes, he blundered his way through what his benefits were, why he was better than anybody else. And and by the end of it, I was none the wiser. It wasn't coherent. I wasn't sold any on it.
Mm.
And I'd said to him, I was like, you're the one to blame here. You don't know what your business is. You don't know what the benefits are. You don't know why people should be buying from you. So if you don't know, and this fish rots from the head down,
yeah.
If you don't know, how the hell is your business development manager going out there convincing people to give you $20, $50, $100,000 worth of work every year?
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. I have a slightly softer approach. Rather than the using...
as you would. This is the marked difference between the two of us.
That's why we work so well together. More of a responsibility. You're 100% responsible.
Yeah.
100% responsible, which is distinct from blame. Like, it's blame that comes, from that.
I'm right, I'm going to change this.
Because it's not, like, I get the aspect of fault. It's just there's a context shift.
Yeah.
So you're 100% responsible for the results that show up in your business.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, whether it's, I always have this conversation. I've got, you know, my staff are underperforming. Same concept. Love it. Like, okay, is there a documented system? Yes or no?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Okay, go on, document the system. Mm. All right. Yes, there is. Well, have you trained them on it? No, I haven't. Okay, well, go and train them on the system.
Yeah.
Or, yes, I have trained them on the system. When was the last time you trained them? Oh, when they started 12 years ago. Okay, well, go and retrain them.
Yeah.
If you can say, yes, there's a system, yes, I've trained them, yes, they get trained regularly,
yeah,
and they're still underperforming, then it's attitudinal. And then you can kind of go, okay, well, you're still responsible for keeping them around tolerating that behavior.
Or of hiring the wrong person or in the first place.
Totally.
Because your vetting process should have been better,
100%.
So you didn't get yourself into a position where you've hired someone that's not suitable for your business.
And I'll take it one step further. So out there, I do a lot of work with trades and construction businesses. And there's some trade shortages out there. I've got some clients that are working in certain industries. One client is on the Gold Coast. He's an arborist.
Yep.
And there's just a shortage of arborists.
Right.
Right. No one's leaving school going, I'm going to be an arborist.
Interested in trees.
Right?
Yeah.
And so, he has this core, he's got a great business, a good core group of employees, but he seems to have this kind of peripheral group that comes in, like, it's constantly like a revolving door,
yeah.
Right? And he's just saying, well, we've got, there's just a shortage of, there's a small talent pool. What I acknowledge him for is rather than sitting there and pissing and moaning about the fact that there's a trade shortage, he's now exploring, and we and I spoke about this, he's now in the process of going, what do we do at an industry level?
Yeah.
Just like pork rebranded itself, just like avocados rebranded itself, bananas as an industry body, how do we kind of rebrand and say, well, you know, I'm going to be in this, and I asked him the question, I said, well, how long are you planning on being in this business for? Well, you know, he's like, well, you know, I don't see myself doing anything else. And he's, I think, maybe just turned 50. So he's got at least another 15, 20 years in the game, even 10 years in the game. That's enough to do something at an industry level.
Yeah. And affect some change.
Yeah. So again, being responsible for that.
Yeah. It takes me on to something else that, and I'm going to, I read a lot of books, and unlike you, I can't do the recall like that, because you know where you've read all these things. I can never remember where I've read these or
all those
heard
years
them
in the beer
whatever.
Industry. Yes, that's what it is.
Like a brain cell's gone. my long term memory. It's always been bad. You know, I get friends at university who go, "Do you remember that time we went out and did this, this, this?" I'm going, "No fucking idea what you're talking
Clearly
about."
Clearly wasn't. No, clearly it was a good night.
I think it was the guy who wrote the 80-20 rule.
Ray
Richard
Dalio.
Koch.
I know.
Richard Koch, who's not one of the Koch brothers, but a different Koch.
Okay.
That was it. He wrote the 80-20 rule, and he also wrote a book, because I've bought both the books, but I've not read them, but it's about unreasonable success. He wrote a book called Unreasonable Success about people that had what he defines as unreasonable success.
Okay.
You know, which on the face of it, they shouldn't have achieved what they have achieved. But then he looked at the patterns of why these people had achieved this unreasonable success. And I heard him on a podcast talking about the book, which is why I remember this point. But he says that one of the things that he found with all these successful people, or these unreasonably successful people, is that when something went wrong for them, they were actually excited about it.
Hmm.
That when there was a problem in their life or whatever happened, they saw it as a massive opportunity and got super excited about what that presented to them, what that problem presented to them. And I think about that now and I go, we're straying off the point about responsibility here, but it's the point with that is to sit there and say, every time something happens, You can't sit there and go, it's your fault, it's my fault, it's whatever. You've got to sit there and say, this is an opportunity.
100%.
An opportunity to learn, an opportunity to get better, an opportunity to downsize. The amount of people, and you've probably had the same, that small business that turn around and say, COVID is the greatest thing that happened to us.
Yeah.
An opportunity to rationalize, get rid of people that they shouldn't have employed in the first place, sort out their systems, readjust their business, whatever it is.
Yeah. Well, I operate from a context, and for those that have listened to my podcast would hear it, is called the new paradigm, which is I create the whole of my own reality, like the whole of it. Not just how it occurs, but I mean all of it. Everything that shows up, I've created in some way, shape, or
form. Trump's been listening to your podcast. He has created his own reality, hasn't he?
We all do. We all do. Yeah. And the thing is, whether we're aware of it or not, we do.
Yeah.
Right? So whether we're consciously creating or we're unconsciously creating. Now, without getting too meta in this conversation, the approach that I take is that when something shows up that I judge is not good or something that's not ideal. In other words, I think I've chosen X and Y's turned up.
Yeah.
It's an opportunity for me to go, okay, well, I created Y. Everything's purposeful.
Yeah.
Like everything's purposeful. I created everything with loving intent. Like it's purposeful. So why did I create Y? Mm. What is it about that? What do I need to remember or learn or kind of what is it showing me?
Mm.
And respond to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Number 10. So we got three more left. This was actually one that isn't technically from a podcast or a mentoring session, but I actually heard this on Dragon's Den, on which was the UK version.
UK one, yeah.
Shark Tank.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was Duncan, Scottish guy, Duncan, can't remember his surname.
Duncan the Scott.
Duncan the Scott. And he reeled this one off in an episode, and I was like, quick, write that fucking shit down. Revenue is vanity, profit is reality, and cash. Oh, see, I've even written it down wrong. Profit. Revenue is vanity.
Profit is sanity.
Profit is sanity.
Cash is king.
Cash is reality.
Oh, cash is reality.
You get that vanity, sanity, reality thing.
Oh, that's, I like the little alliteration going on there,
And I was like, so many years ago, I used to sit there and go, look at our revenue, look at our revenue, look at our revenue's growing. That doesn't matter. That's fucking irrelevant. What's relevant is, number one, is what the profit says at the bottom, all right? That's almost half relevant. The other half is actually what money is in your bank account.
And I think, 100%. I've seen profitable businesses go broke.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Because they can't collect the cash.
On paper.
Yeah.
Like, wow, I'd invest in that company.
Yeah.
And then you look at the balance sheet.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, hang on.
Hundreds of thousands of dollars of creditors.
Bad debt,
yeah.
You know, they're on the drip for everything.
Yeah.
And you just, the cash and doesn't show up on the profit and loss statement.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's 100%. Cash is reality. Although, I mean, I heard something similar. It was one of the early lessons that I learned is same thing is, you know, revenue is vanity, profit is sanity, cash is king.
Yeah.
Same concept.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Totally agree.
Number 11. I think we've discussed number 11 in amongst all the other ones that said, to me, the two important things in business are people and process.
Yeah.
The right people with the right processes and you can achieve anything.
That's all it is.
You know, and I keep looking at that one and going, it's the people, getting the right people in here that, for me, can drive, help drive the business and do things that I can't do.
Mm.
So I've got to keep thinking is to get people that can do things that I can't do.
Yeah. It almost seems cliche because it gets said a lot, but your people are everything. I don't care whether you're manufacturing, retail, or you're in service where actually your product is the people. Your people will make or break because it comes with... And you know, that's my wheelhouse. It's from a culture perspective, it will flavor the processes. It will flavor the effectiveness and the efficiency of the processes. And so, I say it's everything. Obviously, it's not everything because there is the process aspect. But you know, having great processes and shitty people is not going to produce results.
No, having great people following
good processes, 100%.
And that's when it turns into that business that you can make money while you're not,
100%.
When you're not spending all of the time in it.
Yeah.
You know, and again, on Twitter, there was a woman that was said on the, you know, that she'd had a lot of clients come to her this week. She was really stressed leading up to Christmas, huge amount of work on. And I simply replied and says, you're stressed because you don't have things in control. And if you don't have things in control, it means you don't have the right processes in place.
Mm.
She's been in business for fucking 20 years doing this. And I'm like, how can you be stressed? How after 20 years can you be stressed? you should know that when this happens, then this happens, and when that happens, then this happens. And it's all just a little flow chart that says when an extra client comes in, we do this. Even to the point we're saying when lots of clients come in, here is a...
Well, this is how we scale, right?
Yeah, we scale it. Yeah. We go, we've got these people that are our plan B or something like that. So anyway, the last two, one I had written down here and one from Matt downstairs. So the number 12 was consistency trumps creativity. So this was from a podcast about in the early 90s. So I really should remember the guy's name here, but it was an American guy. And he said he was in advertising. He had a platform that did, what do they call it? Programmable ads. And he said every time people with a consistent message that they get to the, in front of people in the first 3 seconds, consistent messaging trumps creativity.
Yeah.
And you look back now and you think about all those fantastic adverts that people won awards for over the years and you go, yeah, they're great. And that's, you know. But honestly, sometimes it's just, you know, car brands saying, well, you'd see car brands, same consistent message about the quality of their product.
100%. It's that frequency, right?
Yeah.
It's that frequency, just the repetition. That's internal and external marketing.
Yeah.
Internal marketing from a culture and core values and behavioral expectations perspective, and then externally from a marketing.
That's a really big point. One of the great books I read was about that, is a cultural book, a guy that, again, here we go. Can't remember the name of the book. Can't remember the fucking author. Can remember the content of the book.
We'll have to get you some Alpha Brain or something, I reckon.
I need to. Do you know what?
Meditation, baby.
Well, no, it's when I read these books, and I kind of, I think it's one thing you said to me is that most, you know, you don't get that your light bulb moment doesn't go on after you read one book. It's like you're picking out two or three key things from each book, and you're compiling them all in the back of your head. So my brain's just going, what do I need to remember? I need to remember this. Do I need to remember the name of the book or who wrote it? I don't, because it's on my bookshelf at home. And if I need to remember it, I'll just go and get the book.
Totally.
You know, so I'll fucking compartmentalize the bits I do need and fuck off the bits I don't need.
So the links will be below the video on the YouTube channel.
Anyway, the consistent, when you talk about consistency of internal culture there, this book was talking about all the great teams in the world that had done fantastic things. And this guy had interviewed the All Blacks.
Yeah, right.
The SEAL team that are catching Osama bin Laden.
SEAL Team 6. Yeah.
And lots of others. But the three I remember was a restaurant company in New York. You know, big restaurant, 30 restaurants. And one thing he said is that when you walk into all of them, the consistent thing that he saw was that it felt like you're walking into a cult.
Yeah.
It felt like it definitely felt you were an outsider. And you were coming into a group of people that had this constant, consistent approach. The restaurant company always did a team huddle at the start that they ran. That was exactly the same process. The huddle was exactly the same. They ran up. I think he said they chanted a mantra.
Yeah.
It's a restaurant company. So he goes, and it wasn't just the chefs and it wasn't just the management. It was the fucking busboys and the doorman and everything. They were all chanting this mantra at the start. He goes, so when you look at it from the outside, you go, what the fuck have I walked into?
Well, you think about a cult, right?
Yeah.
Culture exists in language.
Yeah.
Right? All of our culture, whether it's societal, whether it's in a company, it doesn't matter where it is, whether it's in your local cricket team, there's certain conversations and narratives and mantras. Mm. And that you heard that a lot when Trump, talking about Trump, mentioned Trump a few times here. You know, we talk about the narrative. What's the narrative? And he was masterful at just repeating, factual or otherwise, is irrelevant, but repeating at the same time.
He's doing it now. He's doing it now with the election. He did it 4 years ago with Hillary, lock her up.
Yep.
He's done it for the past 4 years with Make America Great Again.
100%.
Mantra, repetitive, and the people.
Repetition.
You can see 70 fucking million people bought into it.
Yeah. And so so I had the saying, the strongest conversation wins.
Yes.
The strongest conversation wins. So from a cultural perspective internally, and that's why it's important to go back to the one point 11 with people and process, you have the wrong people who have you have one person in your team with a stronger conversation than the collective, that one person will influence the collective conversation.
Yeah.
So it's so critical. And how and then we know that even from a neuroscience perspective.
Yeah.
You know, a repetitive message or narrative or story, which creates meaning, creates a brain pattern and a belief, and we operate consistently with our beliefs and our values. And once you can, you know, reprogram or rewire the brain to have a new set of beliefs which technically is a cult.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
There's just the stigma around that.
Yeah.
But if you can do that from a business perspective where you can have everybody singing literally from the same songbook.
Yeah.
You're going to, their behavior will be consistent with that. Now, that's not to say and to diminish, you know, creativity or independence or none of that, because you can still have that as well, because we're not saying that we need to create robots either.
Yeah.
But being clear on the behavioral expectations and either tolerating that or reinforcing, so tolerating bad, you know, or inconsistent behavioral expectation or reinforcing the ones that you want.
Yeah.
Either you're going to get a result either way. One's going to be consistent with the culture or the vision that's in the company, and one's going to be what I call the default.
So I think consistency for me runs through every part of your business, in that culture, your inward, your outward, just repeating everything. The SEAL Team 6, they said they carried out that raid 100 times on a model scale model of the building and everything.
Yeah.
And they said every time they knew, if we lose a helicopter here, what do we do? If we don't find him here, what do we do? And they'd gone through every, consistently, they knew every single outcome that was going to
happen. And when they lost a helicopter, they knew what to do.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Bravo Zero Dark Thirty or whatever it is, but it's on Netflix.
Right.
It's a good movie on, it's on that very thing.
Right.
It talks about that a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The last one.
This is Matt's. All right.
And he said this to me 3 or 4 months ago. He'd read it off somewhere else. I'm not giving him credit for it because he stole it from somewhere else. And if you can hear me downstairs, he's probably fuming now. Give me some credit. But no, it's honestly, it was like he said. And when I say this to people, when I do talks, I kind of have to say it twice to repeat it. People don't buy the cheapest product. They buy the product that they understand the quickest.
Ooh.
So people don't necessarily buy, people don't buy the cheapest product. They buy what they understand the quickest. And this comes back to that getting your message out there in front of people quickly.
Mm.
The features, advantages, benefits, why they should buy from you, and make it simple.
So it makes sense
to them.
I get that. Yeah,
And one of the things we've been talking about is a free SEMO day, right? So we've been sitting there going, we'll go to businesses and say, we'll come into your business for a day and you have a marketing person for a day free of charge, right? And we've been calling it a free SEMO day. And Nikki, who's one of our clients, said to us, what the fuck does that mean? It means nothing to me. Don't understand it, you know? And I then go, right, well, it's this, 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 and this. And he's like, well, that's 2 or 3 sentences to explain it. So now we're sitting there going, oh, well, what we thought was a great idea, or what we still think is a great idea, isn't necessarily clear. And if we can communicate what we do to people quickly, and they're looking for, they're perhaps looking for 2 or 3 solutions and options, whatever. But if we can cut through to them quickly with something they understand quicker than they understand everything else, they'll buy from us. And it won't necessarily matter about price. Yes, there's always going to be people that buy on price.
I mean, sure, it might be it's an element of the decision-making process based on the value that they see from it. But it's cool. I've never heard that before. But what's coming up for me is that, something experiential, that tasting or that taste test or a test drive.
Which is why they work so well.
That's
because
right.
people
that's what,
get it quicker
that's
because
what
they're
I'm
experiencing
Because they're experiencing it. It's not, it goes from being intellectual and trying to break through the intellectual understanding of something to going, to actually experience, to trying something on, to test driving, to tasting it, to hearing it.
The two things, the reason that came up was because he was saying, you know, when someone gets to your website, you've got like 3 seconds before they either leave or scroll down, was to say right in that front page of the website, right in that first block here, this is what we do.
Yeah.
And this kind of then contrasts with, say, the Simon Sinek approach, which says, let's talk about the why. Why are we in business? Say the why to all of the customers. So this is where there's a bit of a bit of conflict, because Simon Sinek's saying, talk about the why. But this statement says, no, don't talk about the why. Talk about the what you do really quickly and make it really concise and clear.
Mm.
Then let them find out about the why and the fluffy, you know, stuff about the back end of your company and how your culture and all that kind of stuff. But for God's sake, just get it through to them really quickly about what it is that you actually do.
It makes sense because we're all attention. Like that's what we're fighting for. Yeah. It's that attention. So the ability to be able to communicate it clearly and concisely in a short period of time. Mm. And it's interesting. I remember going to a networking group and I think I was doing some sales training at the time and she, you know, I met this lady and she's like, I was talking to this one lady and this other lady was like popped in and joined the conversation. And she said, well, what do you do? And I can't remember what I said. I think I'm a sales trainer and, you know, I work with small to medium-sized companies. So it's just pretty straightforward, right? To which this other third party lady said, oh, no, you don't do that. You make dreams come true or some sort of fluffy bullshit.
Yeah.
And this other lady looked at me and looked at her and if I'd if I'd led with that, what kind of response would I have gotten? I'd
probably punched you.
Right? Yeah, like it's, so
I'd have probably punched you if that's the first thing I heard you say to me.
Totally, right? Could you imagine if all of you, I make dreams come true, so I'm going to, or whatever. It was some version of that. I mean, I'm kind of exaggerating there, but it was some version of that. And this is coming from me, the why, like, you know, I can't say the why guy, Anthony Robbins is the why guy, he's kind of branded that, but someone that is always looking for context, always looking for purpose. Yeah. And I 100% believe that purpose is essential for alignment internally and externally. And you've got to be able to at least spark some sort of interest and attention first before people are even remotely interested in your purpose.
I totally agree with all that. And again, I always now think there's not a right and a wrong answer here.
No.
But I just go, you sat there and you go, I'm a sales trainer. And then someone then says, right, oh, really? Who do you train? Then you get the opportunity to sort of take that a bit further. So one of the things, like, do I have this, you know, patented kind of sales process, and you know, and it's and it and the goal is to help businesses achieve greatness and blah blah blah.
Totally.
But start with the I'm a sales trainer.
Yeah. And I think it's contextual to again, as I said before, but
absolutely.
Yeah. In the context of where I was, I had a beer in my hand and she had a champagne in her hand. It was an evening one and you know, and it was one of those, hey, like, how you doing? Tell me, what do you do?
Yeah.
And it was like a genuine and so to match the tone of the conversation, it was something similar to that. But I also do think, you know, if you talk about that combined with or as, you know, versus the starting with why, will be based on your objectives as well.
Like, yeah.
Are you looking for a kind of a bigger branding conversation or, you know, are you looking for more of a direct response?
Yeah.
Right.
It's and I was thinking this as I was driving up Milton Road today. At the top of the Milton Road is a big billboard there and it's got a giant picture of an ice cream on it, connoisseur ice cream, chocolate. Things, whatever. And there's no taglines, nothing. It's just two pictures of some rather delicious ice cream.
Right.
But that to me is the same thing. I mean, they could have all these kind of flowery kind. So here's some great looking fucking ice cream. So next time you're in the service station, buy our ice cream. Totally. And you're just going, yeah, sure.
We do ice cream.
Fancy an ice cream, actually, now, you know. But that's that. And that's that to me is that, you know, I'm just going to tell you what we do.
Mm.
You know, and not gonna potentially. I think you're right. Context is everything in a networking environment. You've got time to talk about it.
Mm.
You've got time to kind of expand on it. In a non-networking, when you're looking at a billboard for 3 seconds, you just got to tell them what you do.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. That has been. So this is out. This was the 100th podcast, and it's a you and me just talking about stuff. Whether anyone listens to this or watches it, I don't really care because it's
been fun. Yeah.
It's fun. The two words that I wrote down that you've repeated a couple of times, and I'm reading a book, Dr. Stan.
You and I are going to work on this. We are going to do some work.
I am in the middle of reading it, and I still can't remember who.
I've got some exercises.
I can't even remember the name of the book, and I cannot remember the author.
Dr. Stan.
He was on Tim Ferriss. He was on the Tim Ferriss podcast about 2 or 3 months ago. He's a trainer for elite athletes.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so it's one of those books that he's written himself. You know, one of the Amazon prints where you get it and kind of go, yeah, this is not a professional publisher. But anyway, it is a good book, and it's you know, this guy has achieved massive things with athletes around the world.
Yeah,
so
awesome.
You go, oh, I suppose I should listen to what he's got to say. And he's talks about one of these words a lot in the chapter that I'm on at the moment, which is fear. That everything you don't do or everything you're not doing boils down to fear. And that is really the only thing that is really holding you back.
Yeah.
Is some sort of fear of something.
Yeah. I mean, that's I'm going to give the documentary a plug here. It's the documentary that I'm producing and directing right now.
Fuck, this is just like an advertorial for your own fucking podcast.
Anyway. So, you know, talking about a new paradigm versus the old paradigm, you know, what so much of our default behavior springs from a context of fear. Now, it's not the, and what is important for the distinction to be made here is it's not a feeling of fear necessarily. Like we're not always constantly feeling or experience the emotion of fear, but it's a context of fear of, you know, of a perceived future that we've already decided is going to happen and the ramifications of that. And if you even, in fact, if you even boil that down kind of a, to the next cut, if you actually look at it, what most people are afraid of is the emotional state that the set of circumstances that they're going to perceive they're going to produce as a result of taking that.
If I take a risk or I do something down here, I'm going to get myself into an emotional state that I don't want to deal with.
Correct. Right. So it's like, I'm going to, you know, what I've already projected or decided is going to happen is this, this, and this. And these are the circumstances that I think are going to occur as a result.
Yeah.
Most people think that they're like, that's the fear.
Yeah.
Right. But no, if you actually cut the deeper cut here, is I'm afraid of how I'm going to feel.
Yes.
When those emotional, when that circumstances or those perceived circumstances take place. So, yeah, 100%.
The last word you mentioned a number of times is truth, and telling the truth and owning the truth and all those kind of things.
Tell the whole truth.
Yeah. Tell the whole truth.
Yeah.
Explain to me, everyone else, when you say that you need to tell the whole truth, what does that mean?
So, telling your whole truth.
Yeah.
So often, I mean, that looks at tell the truth about how you feel about a particular situation.
Yeah.
Tell the truth about, you know, what you've already decided about a particular situation or somebody. Tell the truth to yourself. It doesn't necessarily mean you need to tell the truth to them. It's not like me going up to you and saying blah, 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 because that's my opinion of that.
Yeah.
But, you know, tell the truth about is this the kind of business I want to be in?
Yeah.
Tell the truth about do I actually want to work with this client or these people? Do I want to sell this product or service?
Yeah.
You know, do I want to have this experience in my life right now and have the courage to tell the truth about, no, actually, you know, I don't want to experience this anymore.
Yeah.
And be okay with that.
Yeah.
And then take action consistent with the truth. What is it that you do want? I know you understand you don't want that. What is it that you do want?
Yeah.
Tell me the truth about that. What do you actually want?
Yeah.
And that sometimes a lot of times it takes courage.
Yeah.
To be able to do that.
Mate, thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Thank you for being on the 100th podcast.
Thanks for the invitation.
Which is also a video cast as well.
Yes.
It's that last thing that you said leads me nicely into what will be podcast number 101.
Oh, great segue.
What? I know. That was almost as if I'd planned it. What 101 will be is if this sounds egotistical and arrogant as fuck, right?
Mm-hmm.
It may do, it may not, but I want to tell my story, because I think there is a lot of flowery bullshit around what I've done and who, you know, I've made a huge amount of mistakes.
Mm.
And I think one of the things that I've got better at in the last year, 18 months, is perhaps owning those mistakes and understanding where I've gone wrong.
Mm.
But I think for me, for what would be quite a, not epiphany, that's the wrong word, but like a, you know, cleaning, cleansing,
cathartic.
Yep. That's the word I was going for. A cathartic exercise would be to sit there and go, this is how I got from there to here.
Mm.
And this, I'll talk about it in the next episode, but there's a defining moment in my life. It's the most bizarre moment, you know, how I actually got here to Australia, for starters.
There are.
Where, you know that sliding doors moment
in
Gwyneth Paltrow, where she does something and it goes in a, you know? And I, and it's one of those weird things that you admit. I got into a fight, right?
Okay.
With a doorman in a nightclub outside of a nightclub in Piccadilly Circus.
Okay.
Right? In 1998, something like that, right? And everything from that point the only way for everything after that to have happened was I have had to have got in that fight.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
if I hadn't got in that fight,
that was the fork in the road.
Nothing of my life would have happened. I wouldn't have got married. I wouldn't have got married. Wouldn't have moved to Australia. Wouldn't have then got divorced. Wouldn't have remarried. Wouldn't have had two kids. Of course, yeah. Wouldn't have met Matt. Wouldn't have built the business. Wouldn't have done all of those things if I hadn't got into a fight outside a nightclub in Piccadilly Circus.
There you go.
And it's weird. And I look back on it now and I just go, fuck.
It's interesting that you've defined a distinct fork in the road. I mean, because obviously that you can apply that to, you know, I've had that thought about stopping for a red light or going through an orange light. It's like, oh, I've just went through that. What if I meant to stop for that? Like what synchronistic kind of turn of events would happen if I stopped? I love that.
I could probably say it's more profound. It's not that point. Do you know what I mean? It's not that point.
No, it was
something else earlier on in the, you know, if I hadn't gone to worked at a particular job, I wouldn't have got that job, blah, blah, blah.
But that one obviously stood out for you.
It stands out to me because it was it was on the face of it, an absolutely stupid, idiotic fucking thing to do. It was absolutely mentally...
I don't think you was a fighter.
Oh, but it wasn't... Okay, it wasn't really a fight.
Oh, right.
It was just a... I mean, there was no punches, but it was more of a...
Well, I had this vision of...
It was more of a...
You and a stout at a British pub.
Sloppy, drunken wrestle. Yeah. It was... Even though we're behind the cameras now, you know, it was a pathetic fight. And I've had good fights. I've had proper fights.
There you go.
Where I have properly landed punches, right? And I'm not proud of those. But this was...
Just a drunk fight.
It's like I can watch Laurel and Hardy fucking fight. It was that. And to be fair, the doorman was no better.
Yeah, right.
You know, he was as bad
as me. And he was sober as a bird.
He was sober as, yeah. And I was like...
That's funny.
Anyway, mate, thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm now built up this 101st podcast and it better be fucking good.
Yeah,
it will be. Thank you for being on that.
You're welcome.
For anyone that didn't get the multiple plugs that was dropped... What's the podcast called?
Zen Business Podcast.
Zen Business Podcast. Yeah. And has the film got a title yet?
It's called A New Paradigm.
When's that due for? I know you've already kind of started it, but where's the...
End of 2021.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. You've got some work to do, haven't you?
I've got some work to do.
In the next 12 months. Mate, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Cheers.